Magazine, and we are here in this initial panel simply to raise the issues, try to glancingly address a number of the things that will be addressed over the next several days, and it's going to be fun. I can tell you we're going to have a good discussion up here. It's an extremely interesting group of five panelists here, which I will briefly introduce. I'll introduce them first. Christine Varney, and immediately to my left, on your left too. She was an FTC commissioner in the Clinton administration who very early on, back in the 90s, started asking questions about privacy and the internet, which was a very useful thing, and still many of those questions need to be asked, which is what we're here to do today. Prior to that, she'd been the chief counsel for the Clinton campaign. She's now back in law practice at Hogan & Hartson, where she heads the internet practice there. Next to her is Jamie Lewis of the Burton Group. Burton Group is a 100-person consulting firm to enterprises on how to use technology, and one of the things that they focus on extensively is identity and security issues. He's CEO of that group. Next to him, Stefan Brands of Credentica, who's also a professor at McGill University in Montreal. Credentica is a firm. No, do you have a product or are you a consulting firm?
We're a startup.
But the startup doesn't really say what you do. You said that last.
But I'm not here to talk about.
He's not here to talk about his company, but they have something to do with security. He knows a lot about privacy and security. You will find. Esther Dyson next to him. I'm sure you're all familiar with Esther. She used to be the chairman of ICANN. She's a well-known expert and pundit on everything connected to the internet, and we're really happy to have her. A longtime writer about these matters. Finally, Kim Taipal. Did I pronounce that right, Kim?
Taipal,
sorry. It says here, Center for Advanced Studies in Science and Technology Policy, which is accurate. He runs that. This guy's, he gave me his card a few minutes ago. His card has nothing on it except his name, and it says kim.taipal.info. That's the entire thing, like two little things. And he's very security conscious, clearly. Doesn't even have an email address. He said, well, if you want to reach me, you go to the web and you click on Contact Me. He's a lawyer who was an investment banker and then had a private equity firm which he's still doing a little of, I understand. But mostly he's now running this group he started, which is basically a think tank, and he's a very Catholic in that he's on the Markle Foundation Task Force on National Security in an Information Age, and he also works on a task force for the Heritage Foundation. He's doing other things that are interesting too. I'm no expert, and I'm really here to moderate, which I'm better at moderating than I am at understanding the issues surrounding identity. But one thing that I do think is interesting, which I think is even the topic of one of the panels coming up, is, you know, if, as I've often written, the internet era is the era of the empowered consumer, then why don't we have control of our identity? I mean, it's sort of a dramatic contradiction, which maybe makes it a false statement to say that it is the era of the empowered consumer. And as John's, the anonymous poet's wonderful little poem there, reiterated, you know, we've all had Scott McNeely to respond to and think about a notion that we should just get over the notion that we have any privacy. Certainly, I don't think most of us want to get over it quite as quickly as Scott did, at least when he said that. I guess he doesn't even necessarily say that anymore, or does he? Is there a sun person here? No. Somebody said he doesn't even believe that anymore. I haven't heard him say that. But I'm one of these guys who, you know, every time I get on an airplane, I think, Jesus, we really should have a national ID card so that we don't have to go through all this ridiculous bullshit. But it's a symptom. Well, we'll get to that. Look, discussion is next. I'm introducing this now. The moment we're in is great because California changed their laws, and then all of a sudden we discovered that every company in the country, including Time Warner, where I work, has been losing massive amounts of employee and customer data, And so we have to thank, I think, the California legislature for having done something, unlike many government entities. And so now we realize that the Veterans Administration lost how many? 26 million? 26 million data records about veterans and 2.5 million active duty service people on a laptop that was in the home of an employee that was stolen. And now, because the publicity, Jamie was telling me, because of the publicity of this, the criminals realized what they had, because the law required that the VA disclose it, and now that data is documentedly on the internet for sale, right? Okay. So that's a little thing. And then I think, in a way, we might end up concluding that one of the best things that's happened recently, with tremendous irony, is that the government is spying on us more than they ever have before, and we now know that. And if the issue is that the public doesn't care about this stuff, which I think most of us agree, we'll hear people say, I think people care about it more than they did 6 months ago, now that we realize that there's all kinds of surveillance going on that we used to think was unconstitutional. And maybe it still is, but it's going on anyway. Anyway, we're going to each speaker here has got some different interesting point of view that will, and we're going to each of them will talk a little bit, but very briefly. We're going to have a discussion. We want to hear from you. I didn't even talk to John, but what, like the last 15 or 20 minutes we'll go into audience stuff, something like that, as much as possible. Christine, you had a good way of describing sort of the historical context. Just give us that.
Sure, and I've been told to do this in 2 minutes. 2 minutes. I'm going to try. First of all, I do need to disclose that I am an attorney in private practice in Liberty, which is here as one of my clients, but they're not paying me to be here, so I can say anything I want, right, guys? And several other of you have either been prosecuted or defended by me, so I hope you'll keep that in mind as I tell you what I think. David asked me for my thoughts in an email, and my grandparents are from a very small village in the west of Ireland, and I was just back there for a cousin's wedding. And it's funny, as you walk through the streets of the town and you see all these people who've known me since I was younger, and the first thing they say to me, and I've never lived in Ireland, is, how long are you home for? Because when you realize that we all, at some point in our ancestry, probably came from very small villages. And in those villages, there was no anonymity whatsoever. There was no privacy. But what there was a lot of context. So that it was a mutually transparent society. For those of you that have never seen the film Waking Ned Devine, I highly recommend it to you because it demonstrates that, at least in Ireland, it took an entire village to perpetrate an identity fraud, and it was for a benign purpose. But if you see it, you'll know what I mean. So growing up in an Irish village, you had only one persona, and you never left it. But I do think that there was this mutuality, so it was generally a benign, mutually transparent society. As we moved to the industrial age, and my parents and my grandparents moved to the United States, and we became much more urban, we allowed for the possibility of multiple personalities or multiple personas. You could be one person in the city and one person back on the farm, and not too often would the twain meet. It, in some ways, gave us a little bit more individual control over what kind of persona we wanted to expose in what venues. But as urbanization grew and the industrial age grew, so too did the role of government. And in the United States, it led to a very strong distrust of what the government knew about us in this country. Contrast that with Western Europe, where the government knew everything about you. Because remember, the government provided the health insurance, the government was the church, and when you were born, you went on the rolls. People find it astonishing that in Western Europe, there is no such thing as voter registration. You're entitled to vote by virtue of the fact that you're born there. So there was you can see the beginnings of a split between Western Europe and the United States. Western Europe's suspicion of what commercial enterprises might know about you, less suspicion of what the government would know about you, and then our suspicion here, what the government would know about us, and then we did enact several laws that may or may not be enforced with varying degrees of success. And we get to the internet age, and now we have a suspicion that everybody knows everything about us, and we don't like it. Again, there's this sense of transparency, but there's no context. So I think what perhaps user-centric identity can do is give us the tools to, again, create context around who we are and what we want to expose to whom at what points in time, including the government. I think that's my 2 minutes.
Wow, admirably succinct, and it was just a little more than 2 minutes. Esther, what do you think the big issues are that we should be talking about here for the next 2 days?
Well, I'm going to not give an overview or talk about big issues. I'm just going to talk about 4 or 5 points that I think we should include, because I think fundamentally identity is much too big to be a single issue. First, simply to do the housekeeping, the accountable net notion is something that came out of a meeting at the Aspen Institute led by David Johnson, who unfortunately is not here but is known to many people. He's somebody that Larry Lessig looks up to, just to make that clear. We wanted an alternative to the notion of hierarchical top-down registration, where the government registers everybody and knows everything and keeps order. We just simply didn't think that was either desirable or really practical or workable. The notion of the accountable net is much more peer-to-peer. I'll be accountable to you, you be accountable to me. That works only if people have at least a persistent identity so that they can be accountable and be held accountable, because what they did yesterday is still attached to them today. The kind of the first commandment of the accountable net is do ask, don't lie. In other words, you have every right to ask, who am I dealing with? Who are you? What have you done? If you find the answer is unsatisfactory, you can refuse to deal with them. Then, of course, you may not get the benefits, including you may not be able to fly. And you don't need to answer. But if you do answer, you may not lie. And if people follow those two rules, do ask is how you protect yourself. Not lying is how you maintain your honor as a citizen and so forth. And if someone asks you directly, did you murder this guy, you're supposed to tell the truth. If those were really observed, they would work pretty well. It's a good way to start. So the accountable net. I have probably 1 minute left. I was at O'Reilly's Where 2.0 conference last week, all about maps and location and GPS and stuff like that. What the conference really was about, it turned out, was identity. It was you in the map, whether it's your avatar in Second Life, your place on a Google map. How do you represent yourself? There are tools for representing yourselves on a map. And suddenly it became quite clear, well, do I need a second LinkedIn for Second Life? Why can't I just use, quote, the real LinkedIn for Second Life? Why can't I be portable, not just from physical to virtual, but through space and through virtual space? And it turned out they were all dealing with this same issue. Finally, the question I'd like to raise is, do we want privacy or do we want attention? A lot of the newest tools are much more about attention, establishing your identity, getting visibility. And as Christine mentioned, yeah, we don't really realize the slime trail we're leaving. And suddenly, when we see it, we may be alarmed. We need to understand other people see it, even if we don't. Thank you.
Thanks, Esther. So Jamie, you know, Jamie's admirably up to date on what actually is happening in this arena. So I've asked him to just sort of glancingly describe some of that.
Well, and to try to sum that up in 2 minutes is a lot. Identity management as a technology discipline has had its roots in the enterprise, which is driven by regulations like Sarbanes-Oxley, Gramm-Leach-Bliley, and a long list of other ones. This more recent trend of user-centrism, I think, started with the participatory web. A lot of people wondering, as Esther talked about, you know, how do you go out and do things like MySpace? We see a lot of talk about federated systems, and the way that I like to think of user-centrism is it's about a conversation about how to change the topology of federation to make sure that the user is an empowered person or a participant in that information flow and can't be easily aced out of that either by accident or by some overt act. And there's a lot going on. I think that there's enough agreement on enough things to constitute this meeting, you know, a lot of people seeing a lot in common. There's certainly, as is usually the case in this kind of thing, not a lot of there's a disagreement at certain fundamental areas of architecture and design that I won't bother you with at this point. But I think that there is a lot of work going on, and some of the things we see with Higgins, with some of the work that Microsoft is doing with InfoCards, with some of the work that others are doing, such as Novell with Bandit and quite a few others, with URL-based identity schemes and things like that, Johannes Ernst and a lot of other people, Johannes is here. There's just a lot going on that shows an enormous amount of energy around this, which I think is a good thing. And I think the stakes are particularly high. I think that for me, I like to think about the struggle that I see going on is just how much security is enough. The Web 2.0 crowd tends to not want things to be complex and hard to implement and easy to deploy and use, which are all very reasonable and understandable. On the other end of the extreme, you have something like a bank who's trying to do secure transactions, and I don't know how you feel, but personally, the term mashup and bank account, I don't want to see those two things. I don't want my bank account mashed up, quite frankly. So, I think that the question, will we have one-size-fits-all framework or will there be something, many different solutions to meet the spectrum of needs or something that we have yet to work out. But the fact that the conversation is occurring is quite frankly pretty exciting and good to see. So I think I'll leave it at that at this point and move on.
Okay, we'll come back to some other things that I know you want to talk about. Stefan. Talk about one of your concerns. I know that you're not sanguine about where we sit right now at all.
That's correct. I'd actually like to start with a quote from 1977 from the U.S. Privacy Protection Study Commission. Let me read that. The real danger is the gradual erosion of individual liberties through the automation, integration, and interconnection of many small, separate record-keeping systems, each of which alone may seem innocuous, even benevolent, and wholly justifiable. So,
what year was that?
1977.
77. Well, that was a prescient.
Of course, what they were talking about with digital identity, all of that is really happening right now, right? The notion of a record-keeping system is really what we now call identity. User account information, right? So you can call it a profile. So the notion of integration of all these record-keeping systems is really what we now call breaking through the identity silos or the walled gardens of identity, connecting the identity silos. So it's new terminology for something that has been studied for many, many decades. And indeed, the definition of digital identity is very close to the definition of personal information in data protection law. The notion of crossing identity silos, it's really all about relying parties being able to get to know you better, right? Getting to know more about you that others already know about you in their own domains. So it's all about essentially personal information flow. Now, the main problem with privacy is, and there's a lot of confusion, so that's really the key message I want to get through, is that it's not about anonymity. When we're trying to protect privacy in these new digital identity infrastructures, it's not about incorporating something new, like building in privacy. It's about protecting something that we have today to a certain degree. Because it's being taken away from us through the integration and automation of all these record-keeping systems. Protecting what we sort of have today is an evolving matter. So if you talk with industry about identity systems, there's a lot of talk about what Kim Cameron has called the identity meta system. It's sort of a system of systems where all kinds of use case-driven solutions can play together in one big system that will potentially allow you to flow personal information about a person from any source to any destination. The question is, how do we build these infrastructures? So the main point I want to make is that privacy is about avoiding the loss of segmentation of your activities with the outside world. And that is a matter of essentially avoiding the rise of correlation handles. It sounds kind of boring at a technical level, but this is the way these systems today are being built is that they have built-in correlation handles for every piece of data.
Correlation what?
Correlation handles. This is what they're like unique identifiers. So not everybody may know you under the same identifiers, but the way most of these systems or all of these systems now are built is that the power is out there to correlate all your transactions. And in an electronic world, of course, there's no physical separation anymore between systems. So consent and awareness doesn't mean much, really, right? So as you listen to the speakers in the next panel, I would urge you to be very critical when they say our systems protect privacy. Ask yourself, do they really do that? And maybe ask questions, so how do you do that? So that's the main message.
So the thing we're losing is what Christine referred to, the ability to have your, one identity in the village, one identity in the city. You had a good way of articulating that before. How did you put that? You don't remember?
Segmentation?
You had some way of saying how, the way we are in the actual world, the non-digital world, that we have...
Well, like Christine said, we have contextual identities which are hooked up to contextual or what I call local identifiers. They don't have meaning outside of a particular context necessarily. Of course, they may accidentally have meaning outside of a particular context, but in a paper-based world, that still gives you a certain protection. In an electronic world, you need to go out of your way to make sure that segmentation is preserved.
Right. Okay, good. Kim, so what have you heard that you disagree with, or what from your point of view should we be thinking about?
Yeah, I guess I'm here because I'm a bomb thrower, and the problem with being
Well,
the problem with being a bomb thrower is there's too many places to throw bombs. So let me start by actually just throwing one right out against the entire conference, the premise of the conference at user-centric identity, and let me just take a shot at that. In 1926, I think, B. Traven wrote a book called The Death Ship about an American sailor who loses his identity papers when his ship sails without him, and the novel is about him dealing with that situation. At one point in the book, he deals with an official who asks him if he has any papers to prove his identity. And he says, "I don't need any papers. I know who I am." And the official looks at him and says, "Well, that may be so, but others want to know as well." And I think that points out one of the problems with talking about user-centric identity. Identity is a duality, and the user is not the only player. Identity is basically a risk. We use identity, and I'm not talking about identity in a Jungian sense about who we are in the world. Identity is really, in the context that we're talking about in systems, is really a method of allocating risk. And there's two parties to that. One is the asserting party, and one is of course the counterparty. The counterparty is who's making an assessment. And so you can think of identity really being as these two pieces. Identity on the one side as being the assertion, and reputation on the other side as being the assessment. And the question of whether you can give user control over their reputation, which is really about a third-party judgment about them in a particular transaction, is really, I would question that fundamental premise. So there's bomb one. The second thing is that...
Why do you question it, though? I mean, be a little more specific about what's wrong with the premise.
Well, I don't think there's, I'm not suggesting there's something wrong with the fundamental concept to give user more control in the transaction of using identity every day and controlling some of the attributes that go along with the assertion of claims about being able to segment claims down so that you give only the features that are relevant to that particular transaction and all of those things. I mean, I think that's all positive. I mean, I think this is all great. I wouldn't be here otherwise. I just think that people need to step back when they're coming up with some of these solutions and really thinking about, it's not all or nothing. I mean, you don't move from, sort of hierarchical control of identity through federation, realize the problems, and give it all to the user. I mean, it is a complex, ecology of identity that we use for various purposes. In this particular context, when we're talking about basically counterparty transactions, I mean, I think the accountable net is that most symmetrical basis. I have equal bargaining power with you. I don't lie to you. I get to ask you whatever the thing is. But that's not the reality of how we use identity every day. Sometimes we use it in very asymmetrical situations. Sometimes it is in symmetrical situations, et cetera. And all I'm suggesting is that we need to take that, that in account, which really brings to the second point I was about to get to, is, identity in all of these circumstances, you really have to think of it in the context of what it's being used for. And in many cases, and I come out of the, I spend a lot of time thinking about national security, so I come from the security side of things. But if you think about it, identity is really, in the context that we're talking about in assertion claims to gain access to resources, is really premised on only one of two or some combination of two security strategies, which is really either accountability or authorization. And authorization burdens the transaction up front with making a trust decision. And that's good in a lot of cases. In a lot of cases, you can get away with that. But that doesn't scale very well. It causes all sorts of other problems. In other circumstances, accountability, which actually works much better to keep systems functioning, has higher degrees of freedom, is more associated with freedom than authorization strategies might be considered, totalitarian. That's great, but accountability strategies don't work well where there's catastrophic outcomes for making a mistake. So my only point here is that all of these things are true and everything that's been said is very important and we should work on these systems, but you have to think about it constantly in the context of the larger picture of how identity is being used. And identity in almost every case, I'm going to make an assertion, for purposes of what we're talking about here, is a counterparty transaction. And in counterparty transactions, there is at least two players and maybe more. And therefore, thinking about it wholly as user-centric, I think leads you down a path that is unsustainable or at least unscalable in a social thing, and where one could claim that society in a sense owns your reputation more than you do. You may own your identity and your assertions, but not the assessments of those.
So. Interesting, Esther. You had something. Grab that mic. Yeah.
I think it's sort of ironic that someone comes in and says he's going to throw a bomb, and that all he wants to talk about is security. The whole point of, to me, if you like, most of this conference is about non-security identity. Security is definitely one part of it, but you're sort of throwing a bomb at a part of the conference that's not trying to attack you. And so I think here we do need to deal with people who care about security, and secured identity is probably going to be a lot less user-centric than much of what we're talking about here. But if I were to rename this conference, I might call it presentation of self. That's what user-centric identity is, as opposed to government-centric identity that's concerned about security. Are you grabbing the mic? Yes, okay, go ahead.
No, just I want to clarify one thing. I mean, I made an error then, because although I do spend a lot of time on national security issues, when I say security, as you very well know, Esther, I don't really mean security in that sense. I'm really talking about security as my shorthand for trust, and it's the trust relationship that I'm talking about. And the problem with trust is that it's relevant to what your particular, what you as the counterparty are willing, what confidence interval are you willing to put on that assertion of a claim to make your trust decision in order to engage in that relationship. So it goes back to, when I'm talking about security, I'm talking about my personal security when I ask you for your claim, when you talk your net-centric thing, and you make some assertion, and I have to make some judgment about whether you're lying or not. That, to me, is what security is, not, national security or keeping people in whatever.
Okay, and there, I will trust you for certain things. There are levels of trust and there are levels of risk.
That's what I'm saying.
And so if I'm going to look at your photo and believe that it's really by you, it's the consequences of you lying to me aren't very high. So again, I think there's a huge spectrum, or if you like, even ladder of the risk one takes and the requirements for airtight security, for making sure that the identity is persistent.
Okay, all three of you, other ones, I just want to speak, but you actually were most aggressive first, so say something quick, Jamie.
Okay. Well, I actually think you're bringing up some valid points, and because centrism of any type, it actually bothers me a little bit, because identity is pretty is very relativistic in many ways. So depending on who's in the conversation, because I can't split myself into 15 pieces, right? There's a government piece of me, there's a this piece of me.
Or you can at least have different facets.
Right. And so I think one of the things that I like about the conversation about user-centrism, even though I've struggled with the term myself, because anytime you enter in any relationship, be it business or personal, you have to surrender something to a common space to create that thing. But I think the thing that I like about this conversation is that today, out on the internet, users, be they in any context, lack sufficient tools to deal with the cognitive load that this situation creates for them, right? And so creating some tools that allow them to understand what trade-offs they're making when, so that that's more of a, you know, so that they can grasp what the hell's happening, you know, and make good decisions, I think, depending on whatever, whether it's on MySpace or dealing with your bank or dealing with somebody on eBay. And then one other, I want to get it in while I have a chance. The other thing is that I think we often focus too much on identity in these situations, because identity can't bear this burden by itself, the cognitive load, right? It's reputation. There's many different aspects, and there has to be underlying aspects of the system for reciprocity is a very good. So I think I agree with you. We're each kind of coming at it from different angles, but so hopefully that helped paint the bigger picture.
Christine.
Well, I was fascinated to hear the exchange between Kim and Esther, and it reminds me, Esther, of when we really years ago tried to dissect what privacy meant, and we came up with it really when people were using a lot of different words, what they were talking about was trust, and that trust had at least four elements. It had authenticity and integrity. How do you know who you're dealing with? Privacy. What do they know about you? What do you know about them? Security. Both mega and personal. And then, interestingly, one that we've never solved, recourse and liability. So what I want to hear over the next 2 days is, how do we build the tools that effectuate privacy, security, authenticity, integrity, and recourse and liability in this new identity-centric framework that's evolving?
Stefan.
I think we need to distinguish between two different kinds of discussions. One is a discussion about identity architectures, digital identity architectures. Another is what are the requirements for a particular use case. So the requirements in a particular use case, let's say, should identity data flow through the user or should it flow in the backend? Should there be a synchronization of identifiers across organizational domains? Sounds kind of jargon-filled, but so those discussions will never be solved because they are evolving as society evolves, and they depend not only on each particular application, but also within the application on the circumstances of each particular interaction. So there's societal interests, there's relying party interests, there's user interests, there may be third-party interests. So this is something that there is no answer for it. We can debate years over that, right? This is something that the main point is that the other discussion where we can make a lot of progress is the discussion about how do we build these identity infrastructures. And the important point that there, I think, is that whatever we do, we have to make sure that these identity infrastructures that allow you to transfer data potentially from any source to any destination, that these infrastructures do not hardwire within them powers, for instance, correlation powers, surveillance powers, security risks, and so forth, that make it impossible for non-technologists to solve the requirements of a particular use case once we impose this digital infrastructure on top of it, and everything is going to work like this. It sounds kind of vague, but so if you, let's say, run a government with a national identity card system that creates central surveillance powers, then lawyers and others can talk all they want about eliminating surveillance capabilities in certain transactions. It's gone. It's over. It's you no longer have it. So I would like to separate these two discussions.
Okay. Esther.
I just want to do a sort of very small ontology of identity. How many of you have more than three email addresses? Okay. 10 years ago, it wouldn't have been the case. How many of you have a blog, a public Flickr ID, some kind of a web page of your own, a website of your own? Okay. See, I see this as being kind of blind evolution where the public, and not you, because you're kind of very specific, but the public at large is going to be the fitness function for a lot of these different identity mechanisms, if you like, everything. And people, some people know how to use them, some don't. I get emails from people who don't even know how to create a proper return email address so that their email comes out with no name in it or something. But over time, we need to co-evolve with people. And of course, it may be blind evolution, but those of you who are vendors or designers in this room need to do some very intelligent design to get something that's going to meet all the fitness functions. But none of this is going to work until users think it's intuitive. Even though it's going to be learned, they need to feel that it's as intuitive and natural as an email address. Oh, I know what that is. I know how it works. I use it. My friends know who I am.
This is a great panel because there's so much spontaneity, but I have real questions. Oh, quickly, Kim. And at what time do we have to end, John?
It should be 10:30.
But we didn't start at 9:30. 10:40, good, okay.
I just want to, I mean, a couple things. One, I agree with everything that's being said, although now let me throw bombs at it.
Cherry bombs.
Yeah. No, look, there's no question that when we're talking about the building of tools that are basically about automating the process for me to manage more of my multiple identities, I'm there. I mean, that's clearly part of the thing, and it revalues a little bit how these identity transactions work and so on and so forth, and I mean, all those things. And that's great, and that's, I mean, obviously the upside of all of this. And I also agree with what Esther said. I mean, all of these, including privacy, for instance, I mean, you know, identity isn't either anonymous or I'm fully identified. It is a continuum of more and more, you know, more and more certainty about your being able to assess that my assertions are correct. It is essentially the confidence interval of making those judgments, and the confidence interval for different purposes will be different. If it's my picture on Flickr, what, you know, you don't really care if I took it or not, even if I assert that. If it is something, you know, that has much more consequences on the back end, whether it's a credit decision or whether it's actually a physical security or a personal security or a national security issue, it has different consequences and requires different features to be assessed and different levels of trust to be judged. I just want to jump to a total different thing. The last point on your list of four things, and I think the answer is there. Moving forward, I think we do it in different places, including on a personal level, and I think the tools ought to think about how those are built in. And it's essentially being able to revoke trust. I mean, it's revocation is really the answer to accountability. The problem that raises, and again, this is, I'm coming at first from a national security point of view, but even all the way down, is that in order to revoke accountability, revoke trust in time to prevent catastrophic outcomes, certainly, but also even regular outcomes, you really need surveillance and monitoring. I mean, and this is, if you look at system security, you'll see that this is actually the path that all security is going on. And I mean security in its broadest sense, not the narrow sense. System security used to be, we used to think we could keep the bad guys out by having firewalls. Well, everybody knows firewalls are for amateurs. I mean, that keeps the amateurs out. Now, security is based primarily, real security is based primarily on code scanning, watching the applications to see that they're doing what they're doing, and even moving to the data level to duplicate data, protect data, being able to recover from actually understanding that you're going to get hit. So if you take that same thing and you apply it to these kinds of transactions, it starts to create some problematic things depending on how you think about privacy, because it really means that you have to in real time assess, you know, I mean, even if we're doing a social trust relationship, at some point I have to say, wait a minute, you know something? She's lying to me. I'm out of this, and move on.
And it doesn't work after the VA has lost and
it
exposed
doesn't. But you know something, it's actually interesting, and this is another thing. I mean, let's go back to the overall thing. I mean, one thing about user-centric one of the interesting threshold issues about it is, are some of the problems we're addressing, like data loss and identity theft really user-centric identity solutions? Or are they data protection? I mean, the VA. People who are losing tapes off the back of trucks that is unencrypted data should go to jail. I mean, that isn't an issue. That's a no-brainer. But that's not an identity issue. That's not a thing and everything. And the other side is also the actual systems that we use to grant credit, for instance. I mean, don't those essentially facilitate identity theft, including, I will actually argue, just to throw another bomb out, that privacy is one of the real reasons we have identity theft. If we didn't rely on secrecy, over-rely on secrecy, particularly secrecy of shared public facts like social security numbers, which is sort of silly using them both as identifier and authenticators. Anyway.
Well, you know, this issue of going to jail if you lose data, you know, there's so many cases where companies have been irresponsible with data that there's no even sense that it is a serious issue for them until very, very recently. I mean, it was the case where the cash registers at Ralph Lauren, wasn't that it, where they had all kinds of data and they were somehow, I forget how it got lost, but there was some serious issues there. So are companies even aware of their responsibilities? Don't we need to see change in a sense of responsibility? I mean, we're way far from putting people in jail just because they lose a little bit of somebody's identity, right?
Right. Well, jail would certainly help. I don't think that companies do actually take this very seriously. Otherwise, they'd put a lot more resources into it, and we'd have a whole lot less of these silly, in my view, completely silly data breach notifications. These data breach notifications and the laws that are being passed to require data breach simply enable companies to continue to avoid taking responsibility. All you have to do is have one law that permits class actions against any company that loses your data, and I assure you, there will be no more data loss. Once you put financial responsibility for keeping the data secure, it will be secure.
Well, in some of it's starting to happen, right? I mean, the cost estimates I've heard the VA to put together the call center to handle.
How much?
The estimates I've heard for the call center the VA had to put together to handle this problem was about $25 million just to put together the call center.
Just in response to the data loss. Yeah.
And then they're paying about 10 bucks a head for.
But that's the government. I mean, you look at companies. Yeah, many of these companies are companies I've defended and counseled after the fact. But, you know, paying a couple of million in a fine to the Federal Trade Commission and another couple million to send notices out is nothing. It's irrelevant. It's a cost of doing business.
What would change is if the consumer's response was catastrophic to company behavior, right? But we are far from that.
And that's about company reputation, which is, I think, something that will evolve as an important player in all this.
Is there a chance that the catastrophic response could be imminent? I mean, the people really are going to start caring about this stuff?
No, absolutely not.
Esther?
I mean, one problem is I don't choose whether ChoicePoint manages my records. Precisely. Consumers need more of a voice in this.
Yeah.
The other thing, I mean, just to analogy, it's useful to think about these things. I mean, one of the problems with identity theft is it's much like an environmental problem. It's concentrated benefits and very distributed harms. So the fact that I have cost me $4,000 or whatever the average is now to undo my identity doesn't really mean anything in the context of an aggregator who is actually benefiting tens of millions of dollars on the other side. So the equation is off. And in that context, one really ought to think about market solutions to that very problem. And it's not just liability issues. The real thing, in my view, is to figure out business models where there's competitive structures that create people who come into that market to solve the problem. Because liability does work, and people will invest in things because of liability. But until you create, and on the liability issue, we're going all over the place, but the liability issue, I actually think the insurance model is probably the best one. Because the insurance model, like in the fire safety kind of thing, the insurance company then comes in, starts to develop standards, insists on clients that do it. So the law that you probably need is that people need to insure against identity loss. You have to have a liability first, and then they have to insure against it. Once you do that, then you have third parties coming in to solve these problems.
Okay, but we could talk all we know about laws that are needed, but does government even realize the problem exists to the degree that it does?
Well, sure. I mean, you know, Hillary Clinton just gave her third major policy speech on privacy, identity, and security last week. I mean, it is becoming a big platform. Nobody can be, as a politician, against privacy or security. Yeah,
but do you see action imminent that would push for the laws of the type that we're describing here?
Because the commercial interests are too great. And, you know, to comment on the last point, Many people in this room have been around privacy and security for the last decade, and I think many of you, and I think Esther and I have concluded, people won't pay for privacy. Not clear to me whether or not they'll pay for security. Not clear to me that you can disaggregate the two, and I'm therefore skeptical that there's a complete market solution.
Can I just channel Esther for a second? Because what she usually says is that people won't pay for privacy, they'll pay for convenience. If you can make if you can make privacy a convenience factor, you know, essentially you can monetize privacy that way, or not monetize it, but incentivize privacy. Yeah.
Well, it is a telling thing, though, that I was in talking to several of my family members about coming to this conference and moderating this panel. In every single case, I had to spend several minutes explaining to them why such a conference should even exist and what the subject of such a panel might even be. I mean, people, this is not on the radar to the degree that we all seem to assume it should be, which is a pretty interesting dichotomy to me.
So, digital identity systems have the potential to solve a lot of the identity theft problems. That's one of the primary objectives. Today, one of the main reasons we have all this identity theft is that there's pretty much no authentication. If you look at the social security number, it's an identifier, not an authenticator, right? And so if you ask technologists, then the solution for that, of course, is to move to what may look a lot to you like a national identity chip card, but it will be able to not only present identifiers, but also to authenticate those. There's tons of techniques that you may want to apply in combination with that. But so this is the promise of digital identity systems infrastructures, that they will make it extremely hard to commit identity theft, right? Because the way identity theft is done is, first of all, that people hack into a system, take some data of yours. Typically, there's an identifier in there, either explicitly or implicitly, because it can be inferred. And then, because there's no segmentation across activity domains, they can get into your other activities on the basis of the same identifier, which is not authenticated. So identity management, digital identity systems and infrastructures, they have the potential to make this attack extremely difficult. The question is, can we build them so that we don't at the same time create a surveillance society?
So the question of is a national identity card a good thing or not is not a yes either. It's not a yes or no answer.
It's how you build it.
It's all how you do it.
Yes.
But in general, you think it could be done in a way that was beneficial.
Yes.
You think that. Yes. Wait. Then you.
Well, let Esther go first.
Okay.
Because I cut her off before.
Okay. Go ahead, Esther.
You didn't cut me off. You just spoke for me eloquently. It seems to me that 10 years from now, we will say we do have a national identity card, like it or not. It's your DNA. And the challenge isn't whether we have the DNA or the chip in our body or the national identity card. It's the database that holds the information with the DNA is the key.
Precisely.
That's what we're really talking about. And like it or not, one way or another, that's going to exist. So the question is, how do we want the database to be managed? How do we want it to be subsetted? How can you get access to it? And most of all, how can you fix it when your identity gets mangled? It may not be identity theft. It may be identity aggregation, where rather than having someone take your identity, they add stuff you don't want to your identity.
Interesting.
And you end up, your identity is mangled because now you're a suspect of the government. I mean, I agree totally with you. Identity theft is a transitory problem. Unfortunately, identity theft is transitory. It will be done in 10, 12 years. The bigger problem is the surveillance problem that's coming, and we're not there yet. Right now, and I would defer to you on this, the massive amounts of data that has been collected from the telecoms, based on what I know, our government can't do very much with. That will change. And the ability to extract information in ways that is not contextual in 10, 12 years, and I think is very frightening.
Well, I think it already exists to some degree, and actually I'll make a slightly different point. Forget actually the intentional collection of data. One thing that everybody should bear in mind, particularly people working on identity issues, are the two concepts of leakage and inference. It doesn't take much to reconcile. I mean, you know, when we talk about empowering users, I mean, it's great. So, you know, you talk to whoever it is that you're talking about giving this conference or whatever, people say, oh, yeah, well, I don't want to give up my name and my social security number. And you go, well, did you know that, for instance, using just your five-digit zip code, your birth date, and your gender, there's 87% uniqueness identity, you know, that you can uniquely identify 87% of the United States population. I mean, the fact is that as the more we, and this is the problem. I mean, actually, the problem with Social Security numbers identity theft is very easy. Let's publish all Social Security numbers. Then they won't have ostensible value as an authenticator, and nobody will use them, and it'll go away. The problem with all of this is the more we move towards digital identity to somehow think that secrecy is the solution to this, is that all you're doing is creating more things for people to steal and that have value and that are inside that thing. And maybe it's an encrypted token, and maybe you can put real security on it, but I would suggest that over time people can break it and that people can create these inferences off of the use of those things. I mean, the NSA has a patent out that can tell you where a user is by measuring the latency of the response time on their request to a web server. There are papers out that can uniquely identify, I think, in the 90 percentile confidence rates, individual PCs by measuring the difference in the timestamp between a known clock. The idea that you can keep every time there's something that gives you an inference about my identity that you can keep putting it into a digital container somehow, I think is wrong. I think the solution actually is, and to identity theft and all these other things, is to move down to more an authoritative expression of identity, the identity broker concept, the other thing, moving back to the village that you were talking about earlier, Christine. I mean, the fact is, if a lot of people are making false assertions about my identity, if there is a place at least I can point to my authoritative identity. In other words, don't issue credit to someone with my name unless you check this. You can do anything else. You can check your own stuff. You can check ChoicePoint. You can do anything else. And you can make a judgment about whether my authoritative identity is sufficient for your trust decision. But at least you have to check my authoritative assertion of identity before you go out and make other decisions.
But, you know, again, you say that we're far from being able to use the data. But, you know, it amazes me when the NSA, when the whole wiretapping thing came up, some Republican senator was defending the administration by saying, oh, well, it was just phone numbers, you know, didn't even realize you could just type a phone number to Google and find out who somebody is. I mean, this is the level of knowledge the senators are at. I mean, that was amazing to me. Who has a comment or question from the audience? Because we owe you the chance to. They are? Well, are there some posted since you're the maestro? Well, could you read it? You tell us what's going on up there. Okay. But are those questions for this panel specifically or for the whole day? Okay. Okay, ask one. You know, be the voice.
Those can't be questions for this panel because some of them were on before people.
Right, that's what I thought too.
Right.
And they were pre-baked also.
Someone is questioning one of my academic papers.
Yeah. Okay, somebody give a verbal question, regardless of the technology. That's my vote.
You can read one
Nobody has any. Okay, well, I have more.
I'm sitting my fucking academic papers.
Which. Ask him about the failure to do real on the ground in human intelligence gathering in Islamic network.
I mean, somebody read one of my academic papers and is questioning why the NSA is spying on us. I don't think that's really relevant for this conference, but you know, if somebody wants to ask me that offline, I'm happy.
That's a little bit narrow, I think, for the moment. Okay, here's a hand with a real-time question.
So I thought it was interesting, Kim, your point about that user-centric identity seemed to be somewhat myopic, but then you talked only about transactions related to identity, and I would claim that there's two pieces there. There's the identity that's a thing, so to speak, and then there are transactions around it, and I agree that user-centric identity makes those transactions actually potentially more difficult, but user-centric identity is really about privacy, not security. And so there are a number of problems we need to solve, one of which is privacy, and user-centric identity helps that only.
I would just repeat my same point. Just like identity is a duality, so is privacy. I mean, great, I can be completely private, but then I can't engage in any social transactions with anybody. I can't go to Esther, meet Esther for lunch because she doesn't trust me, and I can't do credit transactions. I mean, that doesn't work. All of these things are a continuum, and there's a duality that has to be balanced. That's my only point. I'm not on one side or the other. I mean, when I say I work on national security, I'm not like a national security guy. I'm on the other side. I mean, Esther knows this. I read any of my papers. I'm on the civil libertarian side of the national security debate. But the point is that these are dualities.
Security and privacy are not opposites that need to be balanced. That may be so in a paper-based traditional world, but in an electronic world, that's not the case. This is like a major stream of research for decades in computer science. It's possible to get both, and you get better security as a result of it. So, and the other thing, privacy is not the same as anonymity. Anonymity is a point on the spectrum of privacy. Privacy is about my control over my personal information. Who can access it and do what with it? How can they correlate it? And so forth. It's multidimensional. Pure anonymity is one aspect of it. It just means I'm not revealing any identifier, not even a local one. But it doesn't prevent me from transferring attribute information about me in ways that prevent correlation. We know how to do all these things. There's no contradiction in a digital world.
And just one little, I mean, it's not even, they're not balanced choices even in a policy level. This is one of the things I write constantly. The concept of balance between security and privacy is the wrong metaphor. The balanced metaphor begs that there is some fulcrum point at which there is the correct amount of security and the correct amount of privacy. It doesn't exist. What we need to do is try to maximize both within the constraints of the other. It's a calculus equation, not some balancing or arithmetic.
And ID yourself, please, so to speak.
My name is Brett McDowell with Liberty Alliance, and I want to ask a follow-up question to something Stefan raised in the panel, which was the separation of the two discussions. I wanted to make sure you weren't suggesting that we should separate the discussion of policy from the discussion of the technology, because I think that was an inference.
What I was trying to say is that it's close, though. We should try to build these architectures so that they are completely neutral with respect to the policy discussions. So that means when you build, especially privacy and security are matters at the meta system level. So for those of us who've been working, looking a lot at how you can integrate lots of different identity systems into one meta system, privacy and security really have to be addressed at the meta level. And what that means is that as you build the meta architecture that will allow a Liberty Alliance and OpenID and DIX protocols and so forth to our systems that follow these protocols to all play into that, and they can all hook into each other. We the architecture of the Uber system, that is, we need to get that right, meaning we cannot hardwire any privacy erosions and security vis-a-vis insider problems into that architecture. So that's what I'm just saying. We can, and it's possible to separate both, because then it means we can leave the discussion of what exactly is an identity domain, which domains should not be crossable. We can leave that up to policy as it should be. So that if society says it should be possible to have a common identifier, like a sectoral identifier across the following domains in government, then sure, the architecture will support it. If society says no, or individuals or whatever, right, say no, it shouldn't be possible to have back-end transfers of identity data with across all these different domains that have nothing to do with each other, that's too dangerous, then the architecture will support it because it does not have anything in it that violates the requirements on the policy side. So that's how we need to define these architectures. So when we bring in discussions of, oh, for this use case, that is too much privacy, and for that use case, we don't need anonymity, that's the wrong way to look at it. We'll never build a system in that way because these are use cases. Each use case has its own requirements.
So specifically, what do you think of Liberty Alliance?
It's good in particular contexts because it allows, well, the original IDFF architecture allows the sort of the backend sharing of information, and there's a sort of notion of pseudonyms built in, but there is a centralized surveillance power in the identity provider within each circle of trust, and so this has implications for users and service providers who are more autonomous, who have their own interests at stake on the privacy, security, and autonomy and competitive intelligence side vis-a-vis the central party. So there it doesn't work.
Kim, real quick, and then we want to go to this guy here. Oh, and then, okay, we've got somebody there. Well, he has a mic already, but did you...
Just one quick thing. I want to second the thing. I mean, you know, you can separate technology from policy to this extent. Both from the from user control, the user-centric thing, and from policy in the context of protecting civil liberties. The issue is to build into technical systems some point before data attribution where you can intervene for policy. And whether you call that user-centric choice about whether they're giving something up or whether you call it policy that you have to go get a search warrant before you can go to the next stage, the point is to build in, you know, circuit breakers, whatever you want to call them, intervention points, policy appliances, something along the chain of data, something along the chain of data attribution where you can intervene, where human beings can make a decision, regardless of what point they're
at. All right, back there, real quick, and then we'll go here, and then over here. Go ahead.
So this is a slightly different question, but it has to do with the what software is there, et cetera, for establishing the coherence of the person as they produce multiple identities in the network. In some sense, all of our legal institutions, et cetera, sort of want to have a coherent person, an accountable person. But what I find is that as you create multiple identities, it's harder and harder to make them all coherent in the way that we might, you know, want our institutions to make them coherent.
So. Jamie.
Well, the simple answer is that they don't exist in the form that I think they need to exist right now, which is what this conference, I think, in many ways is about. There are some things. I mean, I use a little simple tool called RoboForm out on the web just because it's all I can get. But if you look at what Microsoft is proposing with InfoCards in the Meta system, that's one potential solution that takes us to another level. What the Higgins Trust Framework, which is a framework for building those kinds of tools and includes some of them that is interoperable with, or will be with what Microsoft is talking about, that's another one. I think we're just coming to the point to where in the participatory web, people are starting to get the idea that maybe we should build what you're talking about. So it really doesn't exist to the degree it needs to.
Yeah, let me just challenge it a little bit. I don't want a software that can link all my identities. Thank you very much. I like my identities to be separate and not linkable. And law enforcement, if they're lazy, yeah, they want something that can link multiple identities. But sophisticated law enforcement, I think Kim would acknowledge this, they don't care if you've got multiple identities. All they care about is getting back to the real identity, and then they can take it wherever they need to go. And as a matter of fact, it's a little bit easier for them, if they're sophisticated, when you have multiple identities, because you can use the multiple identities to get to multiple points.
Okay, this real quick, we're really going to, you don't want to go?
The problem with that is, I was talking about the person.
Yeah, he wasn't talking about the back there.
Oh, you mean like a wallet? You mean like something that I can take around?
And that's what I was trying to address. I do think...
Forming personality is a whole other matter.
So if there's one thing, it's something I think you may have raised, there's... Carol Coy Benson, I think, first said it. You know, if you count up all the licenses of all of the people, of every license of personal financial management software ever sold in this country, and then assume every one of them is in use, you get less than 5% of the population. So the degree to which people will actually be motivated to do that is a whole other question.
But
I'll be motivated to do it because that's just my nature.
That's got to be user-centric because I will tell you there isn't one person in this room who agrees it's a good idea to let health insurance link to employment history, link to financial institution. So as long as, you know, there are the intervention points.
They're saying we should be the correlators if we want to do it on our own machine. Right, yeah, exactly.
So,
but though no one in this room thinks it's a good idea, many people in this room worry that it might happen. Right.
Well, actually, I think there are some people who think it's a good idea. We just disagree with them.
Right, but now...
So today, no one in industry is working...
That it's probably... It's happening already. Yeah, thank you. We have several people wanted the mic. I don't know if they have just comments and not questions, they can say them. Because we really have to stop. Nobody's like dying. If you don't have the mic already, you're not going
to
get it.
I wanted to say no one today is working on the notion of a user wallet. If you look at all the industry proposals, they pull out your data in real time from third parties, unless it's self-asserted data, which is a trivial case in many ways. Your own debt, right? But for third-party claims, what is happening today is that there will be no user wallets. All your data will be pulled out in real time from parties, and it may even be encrypted for the destination. So you have no control. There's a notion of consent and awareness, but it's illusory. It's smoke and mirrors. Right.
You do not reassure me.
If I understand what you said, I disagree with it, especially in healthcare. There's a lot of work going on around the notion of a personal health record, which would indeed be controlled by the individual, would be user-centric, would give the user the ability to manage their health data, collecting it from wherever. There are different models of this. When you talk to companies like Simo Health, which is now part of Steve Case's Revolution, or Medical Expense Manager from Intuit, it also includes a financial component, but it's very user-centric.
Unfortunately, we have to wrap up. Luckily, we have a whole two more days of discussion, so I hope that you'll be able to, unless you have a, you had your hand, you want a real comment? Is it just a comment?
No, this is a rhetorical question, which we can answer rhetorical.
Later in the day, it'll be answered. Get the mic.
Just say it instead of...
So I want my driver's license to be sent to my mailing address, because that's what the law requires, and I want to comply with the law. I want my prescriptions mailed to me, and I want my address to be on my insurance policy, and I want my bills to be mailed to me. So I don't think most people in this room know what Stefan's talking about. I certainly don't, but I think we ought to think a lot about that. But so this is partly a question for Stefan. What do I do? I want all those things to have my address.
But that's a trivial problem to solve. Why can't UPS issue me a token where I give that to the vendor and they just send it to UPS and UPS delivers it to my house? I mean, that's a trivial.
The brief answer would be we need smart clients. It's been an anomaly in computing history that as a user we never had the computing power or the bandwidth until 5 years ago. So now we better make use of it. It is possible to put a lot of intelligence in your client.
We've demonstrated there's a lot of excitement about these issues. We've got a lot more time to discuss them. It's a great way to start. Thank you all. Let's keep going.